Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul. Today, we will be reading the following articles: Ask Model Railroader, Step by Step, How to Model a Signature Structure, and The Long Island Railroad and HO Scale. The first section is Ask Model Railroader by Stephen Ott. Question: My HO Scale Broadway Limited Imports Reading Company T1 steam locomotive is making clicking noises. The strange popping, cracking noise is most noticeable in curves. Otherwise, the engine runs fine. I have attached a short video. Any thoughts? Signed, Bill Franz. Answer: Your video doesn't really help me diagnose the source of the sound, since I can't tell what part of the locomotive the sound is coming from. It could be coming from the mechanism, the speaker or sound system, or the track. There are ways you can narrow it down, though. First, if the locomotive is digital command control and sound equipped, eliminate the possibility that it's a faulty sound system by muting the sound effects. On most decoders, pressing function 8 does that. If it still makes the sound with the decoder muted, try placing a finger across the track to stop the engine's forward motion while the motor is still running. If that stops the sound, then the cause is likely a loose part dragging and bumping along the ties or spikes underneath the locomotive. Invert your locomotive in a foam cradle and look for anything that might drag along the track, like a loose stirrup step. If the sound continues, then the cause must be something in the engine's mechanism. If you can spot no obvious binding or jumping in the side rods or valve gear on either side of the locomotive, then the sound must be internal. Take off the boiler and give the drivetrain a good once-over. Look for loose or broken parts that could have fallen into the gears or the motor. Also check for cracked gears or driveshaft linkages. Remove the motor so the drivetrain and wheels can spin freely, then roll it on a track manually to see if you can isolate the source of the sound. Good luck. Question: What causes a steam locomotive's chuff sound? Signed, Tom Huckabee. Answer: That distinctive sound is made by spent steam and exhaust smoke escaping through the smokestack of a steam locomotive. For a more detailed explanation, take a look at Brian Solomon's book, How Steam Locomotives Work. But since my space here is limited, I'll try to boil it down for you. Get it? In a steam locomotive's firebox, fuel is burned to heat the water in the boiler, turning it to steam. As the steam rises, it collects in the steam dome, where it's funneled down the dry pipe to the steam chests atop the cylinders. It's the cylinders that convert the expanding steam into mechanical energy. As the wheels turn, attached mechanical arms called valve gear circulate, pushing the slide valve back and forth inside the steam chest. This routes steam into the front or back of the piston, driving it back and forth. Spent steam is then pushed out and into the smoke box, where it helps carry the smoke from the firebox out the smokestack with a chuff sound. This happens twice per stroke of the piston, so that's two chuffs. But if you listen to a steam engine, it produces four chuff sounds per revolution of the drive wheels, not two. That's because the set of drivers on the other side of the locomotive is rotated 90 degrees, or quartered, ahead of the opposite one, not synchronized with it. The next article is Step by Step by Tim Garland. Ballasting made easy with spray paint. Realistic, prototype-based operations is my favorite aspect of model railroading. On my HO scale, Seaboard Central, this means running solo practice operating sessions to test track arrangements for prototypical performance, free of derailments. Sometimes a simple change that can improve operations may not be immediately evident. But making these changes can be difficult and expensive if the ballast and scenery are already in place. The temporary solution? Spray paint. The notion of using stone texture and camouflage spray paint may seem a bit unusual. However, staring at cork roadbed and unpainted track for months isn't exciting either. With texture paint, I was able to give the cork roadbed a ballasted appearance as I tested track arrangements. Similarly, I was able to tone down the shiny rails and plastic ties on commercial track with camouflage spray paint and assorted hobby paints. Learn more about this in steps 3 and 4. If you're looking for a happy medium between plywood Pacific and finished scenery, consider using spray paint. These easy-to-use methods will give your layout a temporary finished appearance while still moving the model railroad closer to completion. Step 1. Preparing the cork. I use cork roadbed on my layout. After cutting the strip and sheet to fit the location, I glue it down with DAP Dynaflex 230 sealant. Weights and T-pins are handy for holding the cork in place as the sealant dries. Next, I use sandpaper to smooth rough spots, such as the shoulders of the roadbed and uneven transitions between pieces. I also use sandpaper to taper areas away from the tracks around turnouts and end yards. After the sanding is complete, I clean up any cork residue with a shop vacuum. I then fill in gaps with lightweight spackle applied with a plastic trowel. I use DAP patch and paint, but other brands will work. Some touch-up sanding and vacuuming will likely be necessary once the spackle dries. I wrap up this phase of the project by painting the cork with Apple Barrel Pewter Gray Craft Paint 2620E, which you can find at craft stores and some big box retailers. I use a 1-inch wide foam brush to apply the paint, but a similarly sized chip brush would also work. The pewter gray gives the cork a warm granite look. Step 2. Adding texture. Prototype ballast isn't uniform. The ballast in picture 1 is made up of rocks that are brown, tan, and light and dark gray. To capture that look, I use assorted colors of texture spray paint. My go-to colors are Krylon Black Granite 18201 and Charcoal Sand 18202, along with Rust-Oleum Gray Stone 799-2830, Pebble 799-5830, and Mineral Brown 342731. Texture spray paint has a tendency to spatter, so I apply it to the layout sections outdoors. Make sure to wear personal protective gear, i.e. respirator, nitrile gloves, goggles, etc., and work in a well-ventilated area when using the paint. Thoroughly clean the nozzle after each use to prevent it from clogging. For best results, I apply the paint in layers. I typically start with darker colors along the edges and secondary tracks. I shift to lighter colors in the center of the roadbed and on the main line. For embankments and dirt areas, I use mineral brown. Step 3. Painting the track. Next, I turn my attention to the track. To avoid ruining the textured roadbed, I paint the track before securing it to the layout. First, I temporarily position the track on the roadbed to make sure everything fits properly. I then remove the track in sections and place it on a scrap piece of plywood for painting. Working in a well-ventilated area and wearing safety gear, I spray the track with Rust-Oleum Camouflage Earth Brown 279178. Before the paint is dry, I use a scrap piece of wood to clean the railheads. If the paint dries, you can still use wood to remove it, but you'll need to apply more pressure. Stubborn spots can be cleaned with a cotton swab and paint thinner. Step 4. It's all about the details. Prototype cross ties vary in color depending on type and age. The camouflage earth brown captures the look of new creosote treated ties. Tamiya Buff XF-57 is a good match for salt treated ties. As cross ties age, they tend to turn gray. To capture the look of aged ties, I use Tamiya Flat Brown XF-10, Flat Earth XF-52, and Medium Gray XF-20. Sometimes I apply the color's full strength, Other times I dilute them with Tamiya acrylic thinner so the wood grain texture on the ties stands out. Mainline ties tend to be replaced more often than yard ties, so I use less gray on those tracks. On yard and industrial tracks, I use more gray to suggest the ties have been in place longer. Finally, I paint the sides of the rails and tie plates. Rails also vary in color depending on track usage. The rails on busy lines often have a raw umber appearance. On lightly used routes, the color is closer to burnt umber. Tamiya Red Brown XF-64 falls somewhere between raw and burnt umber. Spray paint is a great way to temporarily scenic the right-of-way. The techniques presented here give you the flexibility to test different track and structure arrangements before adding the final scenery. The next section is how to model a signature structure. 3D printing turned this HO scale building from dream to reality. By Harvey Simon, photos by the author. One of the biggest challenges I've encountered on my San Francisco F-Line layout, featured in the July 2018 issue of Model Railroader, has been replicating the actual structures that dot the F-Line. This wasn't as difficult in the Castro section, where the layout's linear design lends itself to a more conventional approach through kit-bashing and modest scratch-building efforts. However, this became more of an issue as construction proceeded into the downtown section, where the layout turns a corner and continues on toward Fisherman's Wharf. Also, with the track bisecting the scene, I needed structures both behind and in front of the track, which created a challenge of composition. I didn't want the foreground to block the view of the background, and with the track making a broad left turn, I also needed to make sure the foreground structures fit within the available footprint. Too many buildings would have choked the scene, especially if an abundance of tall structures were included. My solution is the subject of this article, the circular glass E-Trade building located on Market Street in downtown San Francisco. This prototypically low structure is in an area where pedestrians can wander around amid the trees and grassy areas. The building's natural setting, plus its round shape, provided a modeling opportunity to reduce the layout's congestion while also giving it some much-needed scenery. Trees and ground foam in various colors and textures, not to mention the cool Roo Roo kitchen food truck, give this area a nice scenic pop. Designing the structure. However, the E-Trade building isn't exactly a product that you can buy from your local hobby store. Scratch building would have been a bear, especially the roof, so I chose to 3D print the building. I worked with a local 3D computer-aided design, or CAD designer, Scott Tarsi of CADDesignHelp.com, who did the design and printing. The building was printed in two pieces, the base and roof. I'd taken measurements of one of the 40 or so identical panels of the actual building and gave those to Scott. He was then able to overlay the design onto a photo of the building to make sure everything looked correct and to scale. Aided by a Google satellite photo, Scott then designed the roof. This photo showed something that might have been a skylight in the center of the roof, but it wasn't obvious, so I left it out. My model has 22 panels, about half the number of the actual building. This was a necessary reduction in order to fit the available space. I wasn't sure if this would result in an overly compressed model, so I used a plastic tub to help visualize how everything would look. I thought it looked okay relative to its surroundings, so I proceeded. Assembly and paint. After printing, the first step was to file some of the rougher edges and remove the burrs from the printing process. This was a little stressful, as the 3D printed model is delicate. I used modeler's putty to fill any low spots and gave the model a coat of gray Rust-Oleum primer. This helped to highlight the areas that required some additional sanding. I then airbrushed the base with Tamiya XF-72 Brown and let it dry for a few days. The windows came next. I first made a panel outline by tracing it on paper to get the roof pitch correct, and then made a more exact side-to-side measurement using digital calipers. Next, I made a cutting template from styrene. Note how it fits inside the panel in picture 5. At this point, I made the window frame trim pieces from 0.040-inch by 0.080-inch styrene strips that I'd previously airbrushed, Vallejo 69.062 Mecca Bronze. In hindsight, I should have asked the designer to include these on the model, as the trim work was tedious. After attaching the trim, I cut the windows from clear styrene and glued them in place. This is a little tricky, as the space is tight, as you can see in picture 6, but it's the most crucial part of the model. I used Faller Expert Liquid Cement, which proved to be much neater than cyanoacrylate adhesive. I used the base of a combination square to hold the panel in place while the glue dried. When installing windows, go easy on the glue, as any excess will be visible. I fabricated a doorway from styrene for one panel. The prototype building has a front and back entrance. Since the model is only visible from the back, I only needed one doorway. Then I added the exit only sign on the door from spare decals I had from leftover from an earlier project. The next step was to paint the roof. I used Krylon camouflage, a light tan, and weathered with an India ink wash and some pastel chalks. Before placing the roof, which isn't glued in case a window panel pops out and needs repair, I added a view block. This is important given how easy it is to see through the clear styrene. The view block helps the windows reflect the outside scenery, which mimics the prototype. Finishing touches. I then added the E-Trade lettering and logo, also 3D printed with the letters painted white. For the asterisk between the E and Trade, I used purple and yellow extra fine point markers to color the 3D printed part. The final detail is the ramp walkway leading from the back entrance. I made this by cutting a wood shim and sanding to shape. With the handrails, it adds a realistic feature that also reflects the prototype, albeit on its front side. I landscaped the area using Woodland Scenic's ground foam and Scenic Express super trees. When I took photos of the prototype, I also noticed a Ruru Kitchen food truck, which is headquartered at this location. Using an Oxford die-cast food truck, I was able to quote-unquote truck bash the model into a representation of Ruru Kitchen. Figures, bikers, a few benches, the chain-link fence, and a trash receptacle finished the scene. And with that, the F-Line downtown section is now complete. Harvey Simon and his wife Lisa live in Boone, North Carolina. He retired in 2015 and now teaches part-time at Appalachian State University. The next article is The Long Island Railroad and HO Scale by Brian W. Sharon. Photos by Lou Sassy. My HO Scale Long Island Railroad, or LIRR, layout occupies about 3/4 of my basement. The original model, started in 1988, depicts the Port Jefferson branch from Greenlawn, New York, to the Jamaica neighborhood in Queens. In 2005, when my youngest son went off to college, I cleared out an adjacent 12-by-12-foot room. This gave me space to add the city terminal zone, which runs from Jamaica to Pennsylvania Station. In 2015, I retired and received permission from my wife to expand into the back portion of the finished part of the basement. My primary desire was to model the car float bridges in Long Island City. I also moved an existing freight yard from the Port Jefferson branch to the newly built Atlantic branch. This move gave me some much-needed aisle space. Why the Long Island Railroad? Although I've lived in Maryland most of my life, I was born and raised on the north shore of Long Island. My family lived about 2 miles from the Greenlawn Station and about 5 miles from the Huntington Station. When I was around 7 years old, my dad would take me to Green Lawn and we would watch LIRR Class G5-460s pull into the station with P-54 passenger cars in tow. About a decade later, I sat in my high school classrooms and looked out the window to see Alco C-420 diesels pulling freight and passenger trains. Getting started. As our new house was being built in the late 1980s, I began drafting the LIRR track plan. I kept John Armstrong's, quote, Givens and Druthers in mind during this process. Givens are must-have features, a modeling scale, and things that can't be changed, like room size. Druthers are things we would like to include, but can be flexible with. At the time, I wasn't involved with an operating group, so one of my druthers was that I wanted the train to be able to run unattended if I was talking with a visitor. This led me to design the main line as a double-track folded dogbone. The plan had two branches off the main line. One led to Huntington and then to a freight and passenger yard. The other led to the larger Sunnyside Yard and Jamaica Station in Queens. This section of the layout was completed in 1996. Adding on. In 2005, I expanded the layout. I focused on the LIRR's city terminal zone. This included modeling a reasonable facsimile of New York City. If I had modeled the East River and Pennsylvania Station to scale, it would have taken up most of my house. I selectively compressed both. I always thought that overhead L trains personified a city atmosphere, so I built a double-track elevated loop around my model of New York City so I could run subway cars. In order to show the underground platforms that the LIRR used at Pennsylvania Station, I modeled a cutaway scene. I included the shopping concourse, one level below the station, and the LIRR track platforms below that. Switching gears. It was around this time that a friend of mine who was in the Baltimore Society of Model Engineers invited me to visit their club layout in downtown Baltimore. While I was watching the club members operate trains, I was smitten by a sound-equipped diesel running on direct current. When I got home, I immediately ordered a diesel with sound. When it arrived, and after I ran it a bit, I concluded that I needed to convert to digital command control. I then spent several months rewiring the layout and installing DCC. The model railroad is currently electrically separated into three districts. One is powered by a Digitrax DCS-100 command station. The other two are powered by DB-150 boosters. I mounted several Digitrax UR-91 radio receivers around the layout so trains can be operated with tethered or wireless throttles. In addition, I have a Digitrax LNWI connected to the LocoNet. With the Throttle app, trains can also be run using a smartphone. The Operation Epiphany. In 2008, the Potomac Division of the National Model Railroad Association, or NMRA, asked me if I'd open my layout for tours. I agreed. After the tour was over, a division officer asked if I'd be interested in joining him and several others at an operating session. I found operation added a new dimension to the hobby. Then it was suggested that I host a session. I had no experience setting one up, but I took a crack at it. After the first session, I learned that I needed to make a number of track changes. I had facing point sidings with no runaround and sidings that were too short. Once I made the necessary adjustments, my sessions ran much smoother. The Atlantic Branch. I retired in 2015, giving me more time to work on the layout. My wife, Kathy, was supportive of me expanding the model railroad into the back half of the finished side of the basement. But what to model? While attending a Mideastern Region NMRA convention in New Jersey, I spotted a Freemo module with a car float bridge and a car float. The LIRR had car floats at Long Island City, Queens, and Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. Since the Bay Ridge yard had catenary, which I didn't want to model, I selected Long Island City. The Atlantic Branch is a 5x17-foot island with a backdrop running down the middle. The car float bridges and barges are the focal point on one side of the island. Because a section of the aisle on the Port Jefferson branch was too narrow to accommodate two operators at once, I relocated Holborn Yard to the Atlantic Branch. I also had a fascination with stores and business signs in Brooklyn, so I modeled Flatbush Avenue just behind the relocated yard. I also added an industrial area called Nordstrand Avenue. Layout features. It wasn't my mission to faithfully recreate any specific area. Rather, I wanted to capture the feel of the various parts of Long Island and New York City. For example, the LIRR didn't run close to the Long Island Sound or any of the harbors along the North Shore except on the eastern tip of the island, However, my father owned a small marina on Huntington Harbor, so I built a model of it, which required I locate it on the water. I also love the view one sees when standing on Crab Meadow Beach and looking north at the coast of Connecticut about 12 miles in the distance. I added this scene to the layout as well. All mainline track is Atlas Code 83 FlexTrack. I used Code 70 FlexTrack at Sunnyside Yard. The layout has more than 800 vehicles and 2,000 plus figures. I also added lighting to the original layout and to the Atlantic Branch. In addition to interior building lights, street lights, and operating traffic signals, I've placed more than 40 electroluminescent signs on the layout. These are a combination of off-the-shelf Miller Engineering signs and several custom-made signs made using its experimenters' kits. After I finished the Atlantic Branch, I discovered the MTH Electric Trains HO Scale Metropolitan Transportation Authority subway sets. The R22 cars came with DCC and sound, including conductors with genuine Brooklyn accents announcing station stops. The subway cars inspired me to model an L-line above my rendition of Flatbush Avenue in 2019. While an elevated subway didn't actually run above the prototype location, adding it greatly enhanced the urban atmosphere I was trying to recreate. Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader Magazine, read by Jason Consul.
You've been listening to the Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com. That's TRANES.com, in collaboration with AfterSight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at AfterSight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777 or email contact@AfterSight.org. Thank you for listening.